For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This coming Tuesday evening, the 23rd of January, on Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on PBS stations across the country, the series American Experience is airing yet another first-rate and fascinating documentary, and this one titled Nazi Town, USA. This film examines a phenomenon that is quite striking and troubling. It is a look at just how widespread fascist groups were in the United States in the 1920s and especially the 1930s on the eve of the Second World War, including groups that were quite openly and overtly associated with the Nazi Party in Germany, and just how such a thing was possible and why such a thing occurred is the subject of this really fascinating film, Nazi Town, USA. And I'm very excited to speak with a gentleman largely responsible for the film, Peter Yost, founder of Pangloss Films, which is a documentary film company. His long list of credits includes a number of films for the PBS series Nova. He's done quite a lot of work for National Geographic. His films include Inside North Korea, The Color of Oil, Solitary Confinement, Mysteries of Mental Illness. This happens to be his first film for American Experience. Again, the film airs Tuesday night. It's titled Nazi Town, USA. And Peter Yost, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Gregory. I really appreciate being here and appreciate your interest.
You're welcome. Since I believe this is our first morning show conversation, I would love to just hear from you briefly on your interest in making documentary films and if anything in particular prompted you to want to devote your professional energies and time to this kind of pursuit.
Ah, you and my mother continue to ask the same question. Especially, I've been at it for a number of decades now, and it's always, at least back then, it was a more marginal seeming pursuit. Now I think documentaries have gotten more traction through streaming services and PBS and others that I think there's maybe a wider interest in them. But I've always found them fascinating on a personal level. I was drawn to, I think, as a field, because it allowed me to explore all kinds of different topics. I've made films all over the world on all kinds of things, from science to history to cultural things, to refugee issues, to cockfighting, and everything in between. And so it's a wonderful opportunity to kind of keep learning for me, to explore the world, to meet people, and also hopefully to raise questions and draw attention to issues that resonate for me and perhaps with other people. I think ultimately my goal originally, and it still is today, even as embodied, I hope, in this new project, Nazi Town USA, my goal has long been really to look to the extent possible without bias. I know that's a questionable term, and in our polarized politics these days, that's people, you know, will attack that notion. And certainly one can put an asterisk and say everybody has their own point of view. That said, I personally believe that there is value in each individual thinking for themselves, researching for themselves, reading for themselves, coming to conclusions for themselves and putting ideas out there into our democracy. And so as kind of a citizen of America, I think there's a value, especially these days, in trying to, with a good heart and good intentions, dig into understand how things work to the extent that one can and share those ideas with others and engage in a dialogue. And that's why I'm glad to be here today and proud to have made this film.
Hmm. So whose idea was this film? Was it yours? And if so, how did you, in a sense, kind of come across this topic or come to the conclusion that it would be worthy of this kind of attention?
I brought the idea to PBS, to American Experience, which is the longstanding and very substantive history strand on PBS, and they were immediately interested. And that, to my mind, is very much to their credit. I think they saw it as a timely look at a period in American history that might resonate in certain ways for people today. Personally, I had come to this subject through a friend of mine, a fellow filmmaker and friend named Marshall Curry, who a few years ago had done a very short documentary called Night at the Garden, which listeners can find online if they're curious. And this ended up being about a 7 or 8 minute film where Marshall had come across some of this footage of a German-American Bund rally, essentially with swastikas, and it was a fascist-friendly group, as we explore in the film. But this was a Bund rally that had occurred in Madison Square Garden in New York City in 1939, where they filled Madison Square Garden with, to the naked eye, 20,000-plus Nazis having a rally in America. And Marshall made this film, which was a remarkable film, and released it as a short a number of years ago that actually got an Academy Award nomination. And I had helped him a little bit as an advisor and a friend who was screening copies. And as he was making it, I repeatedly said, this is remarkable, this is remarkable. And if you can get 20,000 of these guys into this one place, Madison Square Garden, what is the broader context of America at the time being the 1920s and in that case the 1930s, that enabled a group like this to exist and exist in those numbers? And so that was really the question that animated this project in my mind. And that was the jumping off point to kind of build a bigger picture and to kind of explore a moment in American history and understand what those currents were.
Very good. By the way, I just have to mention parenthetically, I had the pleasure of interviewing your friend, Marshall Curry, quite a few years ago, many, many years ago, for a film that aired on PBS called Street Fight, which was about the mayoral race in Newark, New Jersey, which ultimately ended in the somewhat surprising victory of Cory Booker. And I really enjoyed the opportunity to speak with him about that wonderfully made film. So it's fun to hear his name again.
Yeah, Marshall's a wonderful filmmaker and a wonderful person. We had gone to college many years ago, and then it's a small world, I guess, but circled back and had similar interests. But he's a fantastic person and actually a producer on this film as well, a consulting producer. He's very supportive of it. And I wouldn't call this, it's not really a companion piece to that film, but for those who have seen his film, which kind of gives a glimpse of that rally and of the Bund, this is perhaps a deeper dive into the broader context.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Peter Yost, one of the producers as well as the writer and director of the next American Experience documentary that airs this Tuesday night on Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on PBS stations across the country. It's called Nazi Town USA, and it explores how fascist groups sprang up actually all across the United States in the 1920s, and especially came to further prominence in the 1930s. And it is an examination of kind of the historical context of this phenomenon. It's an examination of what fascism actually is and how it can be actually an appealing prospect to certain people feeling downtrodden and or marginalized, and certainly can also prey on people's fears. And all of that and more is explored in this wonderfully made film. So once you decide you're going to explore something like this, help us understand sort of what happens next in terms of what avenues you explore and pursue, and in a sense, how this story takes place in your mind even before the film itself begins to tangibly take shape.
Well, it's a long process, as I'm sure you can imagine. And I think your description just now, I thought, was quite apt and accurate in that the film really looks at this moment in time in the 1920s, but really the 1930s, when fascist ideas captured the imagination of people in America and asks the question why and how. And we chose to focus on the German-American Bund, which, as the film explores, was a particular group that had probably roughly 70 branches across the United States from coast to coast. They were quite popular in the Midwest as well, Wisconsin, Illinois, Chicago, any place where there were relatively large German immigrant communities or descendants of Germans or first-generation immigrants as well, they had some traction in the representation. The organization was headquartered in New York City, but again, had branches literally across the country. In any event, we decided, so the broader jumping off point for us was, what was the state of America in the 1930s that made people open in many instances to these kinds of ideas? And the vehicle through which we explored that idea concretely became the German-American Bund. And I think for a number of reasons we did that, not least of which is we were able to find some remarkable footage in the National Archives that we built a number of sequences off of. And this is footage of, in some instances, of German-American Bund meetings. Other footage that seems to strike people as quite powerful is the 1939 rally at Madison Square Garden that we mentioned, that Marshall's film explored, and we do in as well in a different way. But perhaps some of the most striking footage involved summer camps that were geared for young people. And they were essentially indoctrinating centers run by the German-American Bund. And there were a number of these, again, across the United States. They clustered in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, upstate New York, but they were also in the Midwest and out west. And there was a camp in Wisconsin called Camp Hindenburg, on the banks of the Milwaukee River, which is actually near Grafton. And there are a number of stories around that camp as well. But these were essentially centers where members of the German-American Bund often believed that they were the future. And in Germany, Hitler proclaimed his vision for what he called the Thousand-Year Reich, which would be the Nazi Party ruling for 1,000 years. And followers of him here, and the German-American Bund was not strictly an extension of the Nazi Party. We could talk about that if you wish, but it was a separate American version. Some members of the German-American Bund believed that they were the future of America. And they saw these camps as essentially indoctrinating centers for future generations to train them to embrace these ideals and this ideology so that it could be carried into the future. And so, long-winded answer to your question, but we went from the broad idea of wanting to explore the 1930s and what was this fertile ground for these ideas to then choosing the American Bund as our example of how we were going to do this, and in part doing that because we had remarkable archival materials to illustrate that. But truth be told, the German-American Bund was one of many. Some experts have told us upwards of 200 right-wing groups across America at the time, a number of which were fascist or fascist-friendly in certain ways. And so we touch on that briefly in the film with a montage of these groups, but there were groups with all kinds of ideas at that moment in time. And so while it's a film about the German-American Bund, I think it's as much a film about a moment in American history and an exploration of why these right-wing ideas resonated as they did.
I want to talk for a moment about the timing of this and why this particular moment in our history was, in a sense, fertile ground for some of these fascist ideals to, in a sense, take root, perhaps in a way they had not quite before, and spread more extensively than they ever had before. I think one thing that's interesting in your film is, and we'll talk in a moment about this specific moment and what was going on, but I think one point your film makes is that the seeds were already there, because even before we get to the 1920s and 30s, we are already a country and had been for quite some time that had lots of racial segregation and widespread racism, of course, and widespread anti-Semitism as well. And in a sense, that in a sense laid the groundwork. I mean, it was all but a certainty that at some point events would sort of combine to allow those kind of ideas to, in a sense, bloom and grow in a way they hadn't before.
Yes, I think that's a good point. And I think there is, that came to me as a real revelation and an interesting, if sobering, surprise. I think there's a tendency, especially knowing what happened with fascism and Nazism, and with American history, there's a tendency, I think, to look back and say, well, that's not us. That's what happened in Europe. In fact, we fought the good war, which thankfully we did do, and we pushed back against these ideas, and democracy triumphed. And there is a great deal of truth to that, and in many ways we should celebrate that. But that truth is probably more complex than we've often believed. Because the reality is, if one looks back before World War II into this time period of the 20s and 30s, as you suggest, there were all kinds of elements, qualities in America that made these ideas already popular here. It wasn't something that was just in Germany and would have been a foreign import. Specifically, as you suggest, we had not just tolerance for racial segregation in a cultural sense, but in a legal sense. We had very extreme and codified laws of racial segregation, Jim Crow and others, that kept races apart just based on notions of race for no other reason. We had very restrictive immigration act that was passed in 1924 that accepted certain white immigrants from certain countries in the world and literally, if not virtually, banned immigrants from others based on nothing other than race. So these ideas were so extreme that the Nazis' Nuremberg laws, which many of your listeners, I'm sure, will know were the race laws that Hitler and his Nazi party passed to persecute Jews and others, that the Nazi Nuremberg laws in some instances literally borrowed language from American law, from various state legal statutes, California and other states. And so while it can be comfortable to think, again, that these ideas were foreign and that we've long been on the correct side of history, in truth, a number of the more noxious concepts that undergirded fascism and Nazi ideas, even in Germany, were present in America in significant degrees. And so I think that's important. And as we mentioned in the film, we Americans entered World War II after Pearl Harbor and fought the good fight to rid the world of fascism. And that is all very true. But because of that, after the war, there was very little appetite for reckoning with this slightly less positive view of America before the war. And that was sort of just pushed under the rug. And one could argue for a long time, if ever, not really dealt with.
Hmm. One of the things your film explores is the sense of fear that was really gripping the hearts of all kinds of Americans of all kinds of political stripes in the 1930s, and very understandably so. And your film states quite emphatically at one point that many Americans had a very real fear that democracy itself, capitalism itself, were about to collapse. And, of course, we're talking about the Great Depression and those who, of course, were caught in sort of the brutal jaws of the Depression had to feel this fear quite acutely. And it's a striking moment in the film when, as we kind of have a sense of some of this building, President Roosevelt's often quoted statement about fearing fear itself in his first inaugural address. I don't think I've ever stopped to think about those words in quite the same way, that when he was speaking, he was trying to address something that was not only painful for people, but dangerous for the country. Tell us more about that sense of fear, the extent of it, the severity of it, and how that very directly led to the rising popularity of various fascist groups, such as the German-American Bund.
Well, I think you're very right that this was an extreme moment in American history. And with the Great Depression in 1929 and then obviously cascading into the 30s, and the 30s is the period where the Bund developed and spread, that I think the Great Depression, as you suggest, was a massive element in all of this. It created great economic insecurity. And so that is sort of a bottom line that was animating all of this for many, many people in America. And I think it led a lot of people across the country to really ask themselves existential questions about America. People wondered if the American experiment was failing, if democracy was done for, if perhaps democracy wasn't equipped to handle this. Look at how horrible the economy was, et cetera, et cetera. And so it was really a lot of deep questioning that was going on at the time. And there are things that might resonate across time, even till today, that we see. There was a lot of othering of people. When people are afraid, they tend to find scapegoats and people to blame. So there was a lot of that going on. And so that helped fuel the popularity of a group like the Bund or others who blamed it on the Jews or blamed it on minorities or blamed it on whomever. But it was a period where they were looking for somebody to blame because the whole infrastructure of America seemed to be a three-legged table at that moment. And so I think it's a very kind of powerful time.
One thing I appreciate about the film is that You take a little bit of time to take us inside the insidious beliefs of anti-Semitism, particularly during this period. And I really felt like I learned so much about kind of the nature of anti-Semitism and also some of the awful ways in which that belief, that attitude has been defended in some ways that are truly shocking. Your film, for one thing, talks about Henry Ford being a virulent anti-Semite, and also talks about this thing called eugenics, a pseudoscience that was utilized to, in a sense, bolster the case that Jews were somehow both inferior and dangerous to society as a whole. Can you just talk for a moment about some of this and your choice, which I think was the right choice, to spend some time with this in the film?
Absolutely, I'd be happy to. I think sometimes people forget or are unaware of how deep and powerful anti-Semitism has been in America's history, and frankly, in my opinion, remains to this day, and in many ways around the world. I think eugenics, as you mentioned, was a scientific belief in the power of genetic heredity and the idea that you could basically game the system and breed out certain traits in certain races and encourage others. And this was widely embraced by the leading institutions of the time, medical institutions, cultural institutions, whether the American Museum of Natural History or Harvard Medical School and everybody in between. This was widely believed and practiced. And these were ideas that were, again, adopted by the Nazis or embraced as well. So we don't have clean hands on this front. And I think Blacks, minorities, and especially Jews were caught up in that false scientific view of how the world was supposed to work and how people were supposed to work. And I think a very interesting thing that we explore in the film is during this fearful time when people wondered if democracy was done for and if the American experiment was on the ropes, they looked to other alternatives politically, and these included communism. There was a very strong left-wing wave sweeping the world and presence in America as well, and fascism on the right. And I think what's interesting is at the time in terms of anti-Semitism, Jews were considered communists in many instances. In fact, some of FDR's New Deal programs were considered to be communistic. Who, after all, would want to have something so communistic as Social Security or protections in the workplace? This was seen by many on the right at the time as massive government overreach. In many instances, these are things that we just take for granted now. But at the time, that was folded in with radical leftist critique, and people who practiced that were accused of being communists, and they referred to Roosevelt's New Deal as the Jew Deal. This is what the Bund called it, because they tried to label him. He was not Jewish, but they tried to say this is kind of left-leaning, communistic, Jewish kind of stuff. And that's sort of the superficial anti-Semitic trope that has existed across time and surfaced again in this moment. But what's interesting, too, is at the same time that you're saying at that moment that the Jews are raging left-wing communists that are trying to overthrow, you know, the free enterprise system or something like that, which was not accurate, but was fueling this anti-Semitism. At the same time as people were saying that, they were also often critiquing Jews as being capitalist control mongers. So on the right, you know, on the right wing, in the free market, they were considered to be, quote unquote, pulling the strings. These are ideas that Henry Ford put out there in a very noxious, powerful and destructive way. And so just the fact that in that sense, Jews were held up as problems on both on the left as communists and on the right as capitalists. And the one commonality on that is blame the Jews. And that's what Henry Ford did and the Bund did and others did. And Ford is a really remarkable figure. We all, he's of course famous, and we all still see his name every day on the roads all over the place. But he was really a notchous figure in American history when it comes to politics. And it's not known by many, but in a very early reporting trip by the New York Times, before Hitler came to power widely, and he just had a small office in Bavaria, and for the first time, a reporter from New York went to see, who is this guy with his mustache in this little office? And they went to this guy's place, and on his coffee table in his waiting room, he had a number of the pamphlets that Ford had printed, which were anti-Semitic tracts, and over Hitler's desk in his office was a portrait of Ford. So Ford was widely admired by Hitler and by the Nazis, both for his noxious ideas and for his kind of ruthless business approach. But anti-Semitism, I think, at the risk of stating the obvious, was central not just to the Bund's message at the time, but it was a very powerful and destructive current in America as well.
Right. So explain exactly what the appeal of fascism was. And by the way, I think your film does a marvelous job of doing exactly that. But in a nutshell, spelling out all these fears and biases and so on, why did, to so many Americans, why did fascism seem like the long-awaited answer to all of our many societal ills?
I think fascism presented a clear and seemingly simple explanation for problems that in reality were not so clear or simple to solve. And I think at the time it was very tempting to think that here is a strong leader who can take us out of, save us from our problems. And by the way, these problems are because of these people over here, and they have to do with the fact that we are weak. And if we are just strong and unified and all on the same page, all of our problems will go away. And I think that could be a tempting offer at a time where problems seem to be overwhelming and solutions far off and difficult to achieve. But I think that is why these ideas resonated, and it's why historically in Europe, Mussolini and then Hitler, the two main fascist leaders in Europe at the time, were born more or less on the heels of World War I and the horrible economic and social and human destruction that followed. And Europe was a wreck after World War I in many places, in most places. And so it wasn't surprising that it was appealing to have a strong, albeit problematic, path out. And I think America, in some ways on the heels of the Great Depression, was at a difficult time. And in difficult times, one looks for a way out. And for a strong somebody who has a clear story, one might want to follow them.
Let's talk for a moment about this matter of the timing being not only right in terms of what was going on, the fears people had, but also the fact that the full story of how fascism was playing out and would play out in Nazi Germany was not yet known. I mean, that certain horrific things had not yet happened. They were about to happen, but even certain horrible things already underway were not known to the typical American. Just, you know, try to maybe chart for us or quantify for us kind of that level of, let's call it ignorance, in terms of what exactly fascism meant in Nazi Germany at that point in time.
Well, I think there was, it depends, you know, exactly which year and what was known by whom, where. and different people can argue about who knew what. But the broad question, which is very interesting, and it was a filmmaking question as well, and I think it's something that we make the point a couple of times in the film, and viewers might be interested when they watch the film to kind of test this with themselves. This is a highfalutin kind of historian intellectual term, but called presentism, which many historians today kind of caution each other and others to be aware of. And that is, presentism means that one, without being aware of it, brings one's present day biases to bear when they look back on history and they're not aware that they're doing it. So an example would be, if you stop anybody, or not anybody, but most people on the street today, or most listeners to this, and you say, ah, the Nazis, or you show them a swastika, they will presumably have powerful and often negative comments about it, or they'll be like, ooh, the Nazis, they were this, they were this, they were this. And so therefore, when you see the Nazis marching through Wisconsin or Chicago or New York or LA or and hanging swastikas in the 1930s, one would look at them and say, how could they be doing that? That is ridiculous. How could there be swastikas in Los Angeles in 1930, whatever? And they must be idiots. On some level, there can be a judgment brought to bear too, because we know where this went. But the reality is, and what is interesting as a filmmaker and hopefully again as viewers, is to imagine what it was without presentism, to be in the 1930s without knowing where this was going to go. This is just a group that has these ideas that, sure, in some instances could get a little bit ugly, but hey, aren't they speaking some truth over here on these ways? And they didn't know where this was going to go at the time. And that's very important to understand when one watches this film. And so it could be very easy to condemn those who were drawn to these ideas, and perhaps in many instances for good reason, many of the ideas are utterly noxious. But it's also at the same time important to understand that nobody knew where this was going to go. And I think there are lessons for that as whenever we look back in the past, and also when we look at our own moment in time. One never knows how things are going to unfold.
Absolutely. We're speaking with Peter Yost about the next installment in the American Experience series, a film that will air Tuesday night called Nazi Town USA, which examines the rise of fascist groups across the United States in the 1920s and especially into the 1930s, right up to the eve of our entrance into World War II. We have yet to talk about one of the most important figures discussed in your film, namely one Fritz Julius Kuhn, a German-born man who ultimately came here to America and helped to create this especially significant fascist group called the German-American Bund. It's very interesting to learn about his background and in a sense to learn how typical he was as a young German man in the early 1920s in the wake of the First World War, which of course ultimately ended disastrously for Germany. Just say a quick word about how that circumstance sets up so much of what he cared about and fought for.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, again, Kuhn is an interesting character, and he is a through line in our film because he was the national head of the German-American Bund. But I think he's most interesting as because he was typical of a person of that time in America. And Kuhn had fought in World War I, and he'd been a gunner in Germany, and they, of course, lost the war, and the country was ravaged economically and in every other way. Kuhn eventually, like many of his generation, got out of Germany and came to America actually via Mexico. It's a long story we don't have to go into, but ended up in America, worked for Henry Ford, which is interesting, as an X-ray technician in the Henry Ford Hospital in Michigan, and moved around and did different things. And he ended up founding and heading the German-American Bund, which had, again, 70 or so branches across the country. And he was fueled, I think, by the problems that he had faced in Europe, and he imported essentially with him a number of these ideas that, that resonated with the people back in Germany about race and Jews and other things like this. But I think what's interesting, he was eventually jailed on embezzlement charges, and eventually, once the war broke out, deported as an what they called an unregistered foreign agent, because during World War II they had greater latitude to go after people who were not considered loyal to America. But I think what's interesting, Kuhn himself is an interesting character, but he wasn't atypical. I think Wisconsin, for example, had one of the largest German populations in the U.S. at the time. I think something, correct me if I'm wrong, but roughly 40% of the population were either German-born or first-generation German-American. And this is similar to Chicago, New York. A number of cities had a lot of German immigrants. Some had been here much longer, certainly, but some had come over more recently, like Kuhn. And so the struggles and the dislocation that somebody like Kuhn had, they weren't unique. So he's an interesting and important character in the film. Mm.
When this group is created, the German-American Bund, it is in the wake of another group being essentially disbanded by Germany. And that story in and of itself is quite interesting, but I don't think we have time to go into that. But in a sense, the German-American Bund is a new effort to propagate some of these fascist ideals. And one of the things that is quite intriguing, and we see footage that where we see it for ourselves, is the strange and kind of bizarre mixture of symbolism that we especially see with the German-American Bund, maybe where elements of all-American familiarity are maybe a little more prominent, but there are those swastikas. I mean, it's the strangest thing in terms of the visuals, and I'm really glad your film shows us that so clearly.
Absolutely. Well, thanks. And I mean, Kuhn, Fritz Kuhn declared George Washington the original fascist. This was based on nothing substantive. He was the opposite of a fascist, really. He was a true Democrat. But it reveals Kuhn's instinct, an instinct that, frankly, politicians still do to this day, to wrap whatever ideas they have in Americana. And so the German-American Bund, to an extreme, visually and conceptually tried to take these ideas and make them seem American, when in fact, if one looks at them soberly, they are the opposite of American in their core. So it's visually embodied in many ways in the film. Hmm.
We should spend a couple of minutes talking about some of the people who were vocal opponents of what was going on, sounding the alarm. And among them, a remarkable woman by the name of Dorothy Thompson. I'm embarrassed to say this was a name I did not know at all until I saw your film. I suspect I'm probably not unique in that respect. Tell our listeners about Dorothy Thompson, her intriguing story, and why she is an important figure in your film.
Well, Dorothy Thompson is just an inspiration, I think. When we discovered her, we couldn't quite believe it, and we made sure to give her prominence in the film. And actually, the American Experience, the PBS strand, is broadcasting this film and has supported it throughout, created a really great little profile of her on their website. So if one looks at Nazitown USA online to learn more about the film or to ultimately stream it there if they miss the broadcast, there are also certain elements there that we built out to give more information for people who are curious. And Dorothy Thompson, we all agreed, was somebody that we should include more information about. So there's a great essay and some information about her if people interested in learning more. But in a nutshell, she was a woman foreign correspondent, American, which at the time was relatively unusual, as one could imagine. You're talking in the 20s and 30s. She was went to many places, but ended up in Berlin. She called out Hitler very early on for what he was, and actually widely mocked him as a buffoon, as a clown, and earned his complete and utter enmity. She became the first American correspondent to be expelled from Nazi Germany. It was one of the first things that Hitler did when he ascended to power in 1933, is he kicked her out, and she wore that for the rest of her life as a badge of honor. Obviously, she was on the right side of history there. And then she appears again in our film at the Madison Square Garden rally, where in the years leading up to that, she had been speaking out, giving hundreds and hundreds of speeches a year that were anti-fascism, that were anti-Hitler, that were calling out the dangers that these ideas and these people posed to democracy overseas and domestically. So she was an outspoken opponent of all of this. And then that essentially, in our film anyway, climaxes in 1939 at the Madison Square Garden rally, where she, Dorothy Thompson, decides to attend this rally with 20,000 or so fascist-friendly Bund members, and goes with the express intent of disrupting the undertakings and calling it out for what it was. And so she sits in the audience near the front and yells bunk, you know, basically garbage, while she's surrounded by tens of thousands of these Nazis, essentially, and she's thrown out, and then she comes back in, and she does it again, and is thrown out again. So she's a very courageous character, and she's one of a few in our film that we made sure to highlight. There's Rabbi Stephen Weiss, who was obviously a Jewish activist who pushed back and called out what was going on very early on in Nazi Germany. And then there are a number of other journalists and just regular citizens who counter-protested Madison Square Garden. They had 20,000 Bund members inside. They had many times that number outside counter-protesting. And so it's sort of an inspirational story throughout, that as noxious as these ideas were, and even though in many instances they were protected by free speech protections, the counter-protest and the counter-speech really made a difference when one looks back in the history. Hmm. And so that's an interesting thread throughout as well.
Absolutely. When people watch your film, they can especially follow the story of two brothers who go undercover on behalf of a Chicago newspaper and really help kind of blow this story wide open. And one of those brothers, you tell us, becomes really the right-hand man of Fritz Julius Kühn. I mean, seemingly working for him, but in fact, carefully, secretly chronicling all that this group was doing. And your film also tells us the story of one J. Edgar Hoover and his reluctance to bring the forces of the FBI to bear on this, since his fears of communism seem to have been far greater than his fear of fascism. And that is also an important story here of how our sense of what it means to be a true American can be dramatically, drastically different. Well, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There is so much in this film, and it's beautifully constructed. And again, it's titled Nazi Town USA, and it airs Tuesday night on Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on PBS stations across the country, produced, written, and directed by my morning show guest, Peter Yost. Peter Yost, congratulations on a wonderful job with a very complex and important topic, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. I was so glad to be able to speak with you.
Same here. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Monday on the morning show, we're going to remember actor and singer Bill Hayes, for many years a cast member of the soap opera Days of Our Lives, but before that, a member of the cast of Sid Caesar's marvelous show, Your Show of Shows, and he starred on Broadway in Rodgers and Hammerstein's Me and Juliet. That's just a part of his long, rich resume. Bill Hayes died on January 12th. And on Monday, we will replay a portion of my long and illuminating conversation with him recorded several years ago. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today's going to be cloudy, windy, very cold, a high of just 15 degrees. Overnight, bitterly cold, 1 below for the overnight low, and wind chills down to 20 below zero. By tomorrow, Saturday, sunny skies, a high of just 14. Sunday, sunny and a high of 20. Clouds roll in early next week and warmer temperatures up into the mid-30s for daytime highs. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn in Lake Geneva, NPR.